I'd like to thank Geeta for the opportunity to speak to all of you, and also I'd like to thank her for saying that this is going to be a wonderful lecture. So since she said that already, it doesn't really matter what I say now. So what I plan to do here is, before I begin, I'd like to say two things. I mean, since I'm asked to speak on Hinduism, which most of us know has been around for 5,000 years, some say it's been around since the beginning of time, whenever it began. It's a long span, and I'm supposed to speak on it for 1 hour with in half an hour intervals, you know, to follow the pattern of the commercial break. So we'll have halfway through, we'll have our people can dash off, drink water, sing, whatever. But the two things I'd like to say at the beginning, that one, maybe I should have come with a t-shirt saying native informant, because I come from India, but my own relation to Hinduism is that I grew up in a religious family. I grew up learning texts, but I remain largely agnostic, and depending on the audience, sometimes an atheist. That's one thing. The second thing is that as an academic, when I teach about Hinduism, for me, this is not something that comes to me out of books. This is not something that for me is a matter of philosophy. This is something that for me is a matter of politics. Because India right now, just as much as all over the world, India is seeing a rise of religious fundamentalism. And you see Christian fundamentalism in the US, you see Hindu fundamentalism in India, and you see Islamic fundamentalism. And we live in an age where, for us, religion is something that most of us would like to think about politically. Right? And this is the problem with which I would like to begin, which is why I call it the avatars of Hinduism. Using the word ironically, in the sense that there are several ways in which religion has manifested itself over time. So to begin, I mean, some of you may be familiar with this film of Charles Chaplin called Monsieur Verdoux, which is not the funniest of Chaplin's films, but it shows Chaplin as an elderly gentleman who keeps falling in love with or seducing older women, killing them for their money, and at the end of the film, he's put on trial. So he's put in prison, he's awaiting sentence, and then the priest comes to him and he says, "Son, now is your time to make peace with God." And Charlie Chaplin says, "Well, I didn't know we had ever quarreled." Right? And so in that sense, that is the relation to religion that I'm trying to talk about here. That there is a sense in which that link between God and ourselves is something that modernity has rendered very, very problematic. Right, the relation between religion, the relation between questions of identity, questions of faith, and so on. And this is a problem that afflicts us, regardless of whether we are Hindu, Christians, or Muslims. So the question really is that when we speak about Hinduism, as much as when we speak about Christianity or Islam, how do we conceive of religion in an age of modernity? Right? Where questions of understanding individual faith and questions of understanding individual belief have become much more complicated. You either have an objective way of looking at religion, which is to say how governments categorize people. So population consists of Catholics and Protestants, or in India, you are asked by the government census, are you a Hindu or are you a Muslim? You can't say, well, I'm a Hindu by day and a Muslim by night. Nor indeed can you say that I believe in all religions. They'll say, that's all very well, but why don't you tell us who you are? So there is, in some sense, the empty, what I call an empty category of governmentality, where religion becomes just a marker of identity. It's like the way you wear your hair, or the color of your skin, and so on and so forth. The other is where modernity characterizes religion only in terms of an extreme belief. It's seen as a relic from another time. It's seen as something that is atavistic, right? Something that should have cease to exist in an age of disenchantment. This is a disenchanted world that we live in, and so therefore the only way in which we increasingly come to understand religion is in terms of fundamentalism. So when we say religion, we say, ah, this man will die for his beliefs, and immediately the idea of religion conjures up for us the famous or infamous work of Samuel Huntington, The Clash of Civilizations, which is the way in which I think the whole idea of religion has come to be recast. So in one sense, as we have moved forward into modernity, our discourses have moved backwards into the Crusades. So right now we see the world of Christianity standing against the world of Islam, and that is indeed what religion has come to mean to us. Questions of individual belief, to ask somebody, are you religious, is to embarrass them these days. Right? So I think these are the kinds of general set of problems that we're dealing with when we think about Hinduism as well. And very often the idea of religion is conflated with the idea of culture. So when we speak about Islam, particularly in the contemporary world, there is the idea that Islam is one culture. People who are Muslim do one thing, regardless of whether they're in Malaysia dancing to hip-hop, or they are black Muslims in the US, or whether they are Muslims in Saudi Arabia. We see, though, they're all Muslims. And we are not aware of the larger engagements with self and identity that go on there. So there is a conflation of religion and culture, right, which you need to think about. So whether it is Islam or Christianity or Hinduism, again, the same set of problems. I want to insist on this because Hinduism is not something that Hindus do out there in India. We are really thinking about how we relate to religion, how we relate to questions of a metaphysical, how we relate to questions of belief and identity in a modern age where religion, whatever religion it is, has been rendered illegitimate. Right? That's the problem that we are looking at. So what we also need to do is to understand the question of religion not just as texts. And this is a Semitic view of religion that we do have, that when you think about a religion, well, Christianity is centered in the Bible, Islam is centered in the Quran, there is Judaism around the Torah, and then people ask, okay, Hinduism, what text should we read? Well, there are several textbooks that are available, but there is no one text of Hinduism that you could read, which is really the problem. And this is a problem that Hinduism faced in the 19th century when Christian missionaries came to India and asked the Hindu, well, what is your text? They would say there are several, and some of them are not texts. They are things that are remembered. They are oral. Right? So this question of understanding religion also as practice or several practices. Religion is what people do rather than religion being something that people learn and just think. We tend to have an intellectualist approach to religion, and very often in universities that is what is encouraged. If somebody were to teach a course on Hinduism and says, well, Hinduism is what people do, then it's going to take you a few hundred years to find out what exactly Hinduism is, and you have to know about Hinduism in the space of 1 month, which means you read two texts. Right? So this textualist approach to religion is something that we need to throw into some kind of a critical category. And lastly, the problem of conversion, which is again a problem in modernity, because when people decide to convert, we are always not thinking about St. Paul. We're not thinking about St. Paul being blinded on the road to Damascus. We're not thinking about that individual moment of epiphany when somebody is convinced that there is a transcendental moment in one's life. Well, we ask the question, so by converting, what do they hope to gain? We have a very pragmatic approach to the issue of conversion. Again, so right now, when you read the American newspapers, you think about the scare. Large numbers of people are converting to Islam. And Islam is called the fastest growing religion. Like Audi may be the fastest selling car. So Islam is the fastest, you know, growing religion. So how do we understand this? So the idea of conversion, again, comes to be divorced from the question of belief and personal transformation. It comes to be seen as something that's mere opportunism or pragmatism and so on. So let's get on to the lecture is divided into four, which allows me to make a halfway break. If it had been divided into five, that would have been more difficult. Right? So this is divided into four. So the first two sections that I shall be speaking about are to relate to the contemporary and the colonial. And the next half is related to trying to understand how and why the problem of communalism, which is Indian English for saying antagonistic relation between religions, how does that come about? Right? So if you look at modern Hinduism is certainly not only about the Upanishads and the Vedas and the sacred dissensions so beautifully collected by Max Müller in the 54 volumes. As numbers of volumes increase, the number of people reading them decrease, as we know with the collected works of Kim Il-sung III and so on and so forth. Right? So when you think about modern religious sects and their practices, there is a wide range of new religious movements in India right now, which are Hindu religious movements in a nominal sense. They may call themselves Hindu, but the range of practices that they draw upon, the range of beliefs that they draw upon are fairly eclectic. So I've named three here, three prominent movements. One is that of a man called Sai Baba, who is based in the southern state of Andhra Pradesh, who has a worldwide following, including former Italian prime ministers and presidents, former members of the Royal Society for Physics and so on and so forth. So he's somebody who seems to transcend this divide between religion and the profane. But Sai Baba is somebody who speaks about Islam, he speaks about Christianity, he speaks about Hinduism, and within Hinduism he speaks about a wide variety of positions, and he also goes back to the Islamic mystical tradition. So Sai Baba's guru is supposed to have been an Islamic mystic. So, but he, Sai Baba, is a Hindu. His followers are largely Hindu. He represents himself as a modern version of Hinduism. But the symbol that he adopts for his religion incorporates elements from all religions. So is this Hinduism or is this not Hinduism? Right? Now, these either-or questions that we are forced to ask, which is again a function of the dichotomies of modernity, you probably need to think these differently, that things can be both something and something else, rather than either something or something else. Right? So Sai Baba is one person. The other is Amritanandamayi. Amritanandamayi is somebody who comes from one of the lowest castes. She comes from the fisher people caste, right, on the southern coast of India, the state from where I come from. So there's a parochial reason for mentioning her. She too has a worldwide following, and she too draws upon a wide variety of religions. Now, in one sense, her rendering of Hinduism may be considered modern because she secularizes Hinduism, right? In the sense that when she speaks about Hinduism, it is a civic religion. It's about doing good in the world. She says it's better to clean drains than to go and pray at a temple. That the ideal form of service is service towards humankind. There are echoes here of Christianity. There are echoes here of Mother Teresa. Right? So what is this that we are speaking about? So we are speaking about a rendition of Hinduism, which is also a civic religion. And then there are the Brahma Kumaris, who are another sect, which consists only of women. It's almost like a monastic order. These are women who remain celibate all their lives, devote their lives to meditation and serving the poor. All of these are encompassed within that definition of Hinduism. So what is interesting again is that when we think about Hinduism, we think about the caste system. We think about the Brahmin at the top and we think about the untouchables at the bottom. What is interesting is that these three figures that I mentioned all come from the lowest castes. They command a following of Brahmins. There are Brahmins who otherwise in their daily life would observe strict rituals, right? So that if they're eating at a table and something is touched with their right hand as they eat, that dish would be removed from the table, but they would go and embrace Mata Amritanandamayi, who comes from the lowest possible caste. So there's something happening here. There is an infringement of Hinduism. One can speak about it as an infringement of Hinduism or a violation of rules, but it's certainly not that. There's something more complex that's happening. There are other modern renditions of religion, right, which we need to think about, which are much more cerebral. So if you're a reader, if you're a university, like when I was at university, a lot of us read the philosopher J. Krishnamurti. Penguin has brought out the collected works of J. Krishnamurti. J. Krishnamurti speaks about ideas which are derived from the higher textual tradition, from the Upanishads, from the Vedas. He says people don't need a teacher. Your only teacher is yourself. Look within yourself. And he speaks about ideas. And similarly, there are other movements of those kinds. But these are all movements in which the propagators of the religion are Brahmins. They come from a Brahminical textual tradition, and they render religion as a matter of reflection, religion as a matter of intellectual activity, rather than religion as a matter of doing. Right? And there is a fundamental division here. When you think about Amritanandamayi and Sai Baba, they grew up within a culture of work, of labor. And so therefore religion is about doing. The Brahminical new religions are about thinking. This is possibly a division that we could keep in mind. Now, what I want to think about here is that when you think about contemporary Hinduism in the present, what is Hinduism now? And Hinduism now, or the people who claim to represent Hinduism now, the Hindu fundamentalist parties, have an entire discourse of masculinity, that Hinduism has become soft. It is a religion that is 5,000 years old. Over a period of time, it has lost its vitality. It's become feminine. And therefore it needs to become masculine. And of course masculine involves hitting people on the head or killing people. There's a kind of very basic distinction that these people make. So this Hindu discourse of masculinity characterizes Indian society as being a soft society. Now for those of you who think that this is something that's peculiar to India, you need to read American journals post 9/11 and reporting. This is something that I'm telling you from the June issues of the Atlantic Monthly and the New Yorker. There have been articles that have appeared in which there's one particular article in the Atlantic Monthly which speaks about the supposed approach of Palestinians towards the Israeli state. And as you know, there is considerable violence going on. The politics of the case I shan't exactly, or the ethics of the situation I shan't discuss here. But the Atlantic Monthly article represents the Palestinians as saying that the Israelis have been used to too many years of peace, therefore we can inflict violence on them. Their society is like the society of a cobweb, a spider's cobweb. It looks strong, you touch it and it collapses. And so this is the rhetoric that right-wingers are using to show that religions all over the world need to become more masculine in the face of a militant Islam and so on and so forth. So this discourse is used in different ways in different countries. It's being used in America, it's being used in India and so on. All, as Tolstoy said at the beginning of Anna Karenina, all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is different in its own way. All fundamentalisms are alike, whether it is Christianity, Hinduism or Islam, they're all alike in terms of their discourse. So what characterizes Hinduism now and this discourse of masculinity that we need to strike back against the Muslim? And remember, this is an argument being made by a majority. It is a majority which feels itself to be a minority, right? Which then has this discourse against the Muslims. So religion comes to be constituted, comes to be understood as an aggression directed outwards, and inside you reconstitute the family, which means that women stay at home, the men go outside and fight. And this is characteristic of Islamic fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism in the US, and Hindu fundamentalism in India. As I said, all fundamentalisms are alike. So when we think about religion now and political definitions of religion, we're thinking about the reordering of our most intimate spaces. We're speaking about reordering of the body, we're speaking about reordering of emotion, we're thinking about a reordering of that notion, that vague idea that we call love, which brings man and woman together in a family. All of these are being redefined in the name of religion. Right? So this is where religion is not something that has been earlier, it's been a question of faith and belief, now it's becoming something that's been redefined much larger. I use the Hindi films to actually speak about religion and speak about politics and speak about history in my classes back in India. A lot of you may not have seen Hindi films, but a lot of you do see Hollywood films and German films or whatever. And I think much more when we think about the popular imagination, the ideas that are prevalent in the public sphere, it's certainly not Gadamer and Habermas that people speak about on the roads, nor do they think with. They think with what they see, they think with the comic books that they read, they think with the fiction, they think with the right-wing magazines, they think with the Hollywood film. And if you think about Matrix Reloaded, which was released recently, there are the evocations of religion. There is a strong undercurrent, the Zion, and so on. There is an evocation of another time, there is an evocation of a collectivity, there is an evocation of a modern space where people are afraid, where nothing seems real. The real emotion happens when you sway to those rhythms of the drum in Zion in a cavern. Right? So Hollywood, just as much as Bollywood, as we call Hindi film, because it's made in Bombay, what are the changes that has happened in film in my lifetime? And for me, that is an indication of changing definitions of Hinduism as well. So the early films tended to idealize, and this is something that you can think about as I speak, you can think about your own films. They tended to, early films of the 40s, 50s, and 60s tended to idealize religion. So Christianity came to be represented by its qualities of charity, love, forbearance, sacrifice. The Muslim was represented by a sense of self-abnegation, somebody who is willing to give himself up, surrender, somebody who would give up his life in most cases to save the Hindu and so on. Okay? Those were the kinds of images that came up. So if you found a hero who was wronged in a Hindi film, suddenly you would find the shadow of a cross in the background and he would stand there looking quite sad, and we knew, okay, so this is a representation. So religion figured in benign ways. You also had the idea of religion as a court of last resort. So when somebody was dying, somebody was being beaten up, usually the mother would pray, the mother being the repository of tradition, mother would pray to God, and said there'd be flashes of lightning, the temple bells would ring, and the miracle would happen. All you had when the time when I was growing up, the time of the anti-hero of the 70s and 80s, the great figure of Amitabh Bachchan, who is our most famous iconic actor, the equivalent of Marlon Brando, he had a different relation with God. He would go to a temple, and there's this famous scene from a film which is called Deewar, where he rises from being a poor boy to a gangster, the gangster who rules an entire city, and so on. So his relation with God is to go and ask God, saying, look, I don't really much care for you, but I've come to ask you a favor. You have to do this for me. Very much as our relation to God is. When you're in crisis, we think of him. But here, he had a much more complicated, it's a very macho relation to God. Like, you do something for me, look, I'm not asking too much, right? So, different ways Hinduism was being represented in the film. Now, when you think about Hinduism as it's represented in the film, there is only one representation that comes through. Hinduism consists of rituals done by women within the family for others. So Hinduism is about the subordination of women within the domestic space, and it's an extremely ritualized religion. A woman has to spend her time in incessant prayer, even such as was not demanded of nuns in medieval Europe. Incessant prayer. And you're also thinking about a global Hinduism that's being envisaged. So the Hindi film made in Bombay is now circulated across the ocean to America, to Africa, to Hindu communities that exist all over the world, creating a notion of a larger Hinduism, which is premised around domesticity, around prayer, around one notion of what Hinduism is, an upper caste Hinduism. It's not about the Shudra religions that I spoke about. It's not about Sai Baba. It's not about Amritanandamayi. It's about an upper caste rendition of religion. And some films go to absurd extents to show you, well, to be religious is also to be hep and hip, to be with it. So you have heroines who suddenly discover, looking at the calendar, that St. Valentine's Day and a Hindu feast happens on the same day. So she tells herself, sitting in the room, that the first man I see by moonlight tonight sins. Today is a day when St. Valentine's Day and this feast day comes together. That shall be the man I love. And of course, that's what happens. So you have a reconciliation of the modern and the traditional and so on. Now, the reason why I'm speaking about all of this is that when we think about religion, we have a very confined, narrow version of religion. Religion is all around us. As Pierre Bourdieu, the sociologist, once said, there are things which go without saying because they come without saying. Right? There is a state in which people are thinking and are being exposed to religion without actually being exposed to religious text. And there are various diverse practices within Hinduism which are an embarrassment for the academic, which very few academics wish to talk about. There are sects which revel in alternative sexualities. Like, for example, in the state that I come from, every year there is an annual festival to a goddess in which men dress up as women and perform. They go and dance and drink and dance around the goddess. This is Hinduism as well. Right? Which allows for a celebration of alternative sexualities, and these are men who are bus drivers and bureaucrats, but they come together during that space. Now, how do we understand this? Do we say, oh, this is not Hinduism, this is a perversion? And so I think what we need to understand here is that Hinduism is not text. Hinduism is practice. Once we understand Hinduism as practice, we also know, and this is important for me, we also know how to combat a political definition of Hinduism. Right? How do we engage with those spaces in which people live, not in the libraries where academics study? Right? Religion is happening there, all around us. So, that's the posing of the contemporary problem. Now I'll go on to what I call the embarrassment regarding practice. Now, why is there this great embarrassment regarding practice? So that religion comes to be confined only to departments of Indology, for example, that Hinduism is about the Vedas, learning Sanskrit, learning Pali, all of which is important. I'm not saying that it's not. But it's not just that academic enterprise. So what is Hinduism? Is it text, or is it practice, or is it both? And for me, as a political person born a Hindu, for me to look at practice is very important. Now, what I'm trying to do here by looking at the colonial period is to look at how this idea that religion is based on the texts came about. Right? And we are speaking here about a legacy that goes back around 200 years. Now, it's not just saying, well, everything that is wrong with India has to do with colonialism. Right? We were wonderful people singing, happy and free until colonialism came along. That's not what I'm arguing here. We're speaking about a particular understanding of religion where there was the period of the early British Orientalists in the late 18th century, people like William Jones, child prodigy who knew six languages by the time he was the age of seven. So for him, learning Sanskrit was, you know, like probably learning how to cycle. And William Jones, Colebrook, these are the people who came to India, and a well-known scholar has called this the age of Indophilia, love of India. These were not the scholars who came, English scholars who came to India, who saw India as backward, savage, barbarous, and so on. These were people who loved India because they had another paradigm to think with. Think about this as a period before the high noon of colonialism. This is when colonialism was a tender infant learning how to walk. Right? It wasn't the period of the mid-19th century when colonialism rules. So at this point, they also came out of the Scottish Enlightenment in Europe. They came from an idea of comparative civilizations, where you tended to look at civilizations along a large scale, where you are also informed by the idea of the myth of Babel in the Bible, right? That initially everybody spoke the same language. It was human arrogance which led to God destroying that tower and not inventing language, but splitting people, dividing them along the lines of language. So the idea was that everything once had a common origin. So regardless of whether you were Hindu or Christian or Islamic or whatever. So William Jones had this idea that Sanskrit, Latin, and Greek were all related. They all came out of the same family of languages, and maybe Sanskrit even preceded Latin and Greek. It's that utopian moment when human beings all spoke the same language. They were not divided by speech. So this idea of comparative civilization led to an understanding of India which was very benign. It was an attempt to, so that even Voltaire used to say, well, if you look at the word Christ and you look at the word Krishna, the commonality, the Krish, which united them. So Christ is actually Krishna, Krishna is actually Christ. Now, why Voltaire is saying this was not because he had a drink too many, but at that point it was an attack against the clerisy, as you all know, the whole history of anti-clericalism in France and so on. So there are various ways in the late 18th century where Hinduism came to be seen as akin to the great religions of the world, and faithfully, both Colebrook and Jones argued that Hinduism consisted of the text. What is Hinduism? It consists of the Shastras, it consists of the Vedas, it consists of the Upanishads and so on. What is Islam? Islam is available in the Quran. Now, why did they say this? Right? Part of it is this theory of comparative civilization. Part of it is the colonial necessity to rule. At that point, colonial government felt, the East India Company felt that if it had to rule, if it had to make laws for this native population, where should they look to? And seeing India as a quintessentially religious country, they felt that Hindus and Muslims ought to be governed by religious laws. Now, how do you know what is a religious law? You go to the text. And therefore, Hindus and Muslims came to be governed by the Shastras and by the Quran, respectively, with tremendous consequences. Tremendous consequences in the sense that the wide variety of practices, the wide variety of local custom, the wide variety of legal traditions, all of it got sidelined. All of it got set aside. It became the texts which came to predominate. Now, one of the things that is interesting as well is that why did they ignore, and this is a tradition that continues beyond Colebrook and Jones, why did they choose to ignore popular religion? Why did they choose to ignore religious practice? And here again, we must think back to a debate that is happening not in India, but a debate that is happening in Europe. That bitter struggle between Protestantism and Catholicism, where Protestants tended to see Catholicism as being superstitious, as being informed by the priesthood, the rule of the priesthood, as informed by a variety of worship of saints and, you know, random feast days and so on. So when they came to India, they tended to look at Hinduism as an unreformed Catholicism. So what we have available for us is a Protestant critique, in some sense, of Hinduism, which we then understand as Hinduism. So the 18th and 19th century Protestant critique of Hinduism, coming out of debates in Europe, where Hinduism comes to be understood as an unreformed Catholicism, right, characterized by Brahmins, priests characterized by a variety of gargoyles and saints and so on. So the question here, and I shall take up two issues and we'll stop for our commercial break. The question is, I'll take up two case studies as to what happens as a consequence of this. So what have we said so far? That the colonial government, in conjunction with these lovers of India, I mean, you don't have to subscribe to Said's argument about Orientalism. Being hostile to a culture has its problems, loving a culture too much has its problems as well. Right? So it's a complicated position. So if everything is based on the text, what are the consequences? So what happens here is that a high caste notion of law comes to be transplanted all over India as Hindu law. The law that is contained in the Shastras and the Manusmriti and other texts, a law that is formulated by the upper caste, by the Brahmins, comes to rule a country. Right? So there is an unholy alliance of English law and Brahminical law, and what you have is not the rule of law. You have a strange animal that is neither English nor Brahmin. Right? It's a law that is a strange marriage. It's like a creature with horns. So when you have the early debates that go on about Sati, you may have heard about Sati, where the, it would be called a murder is the word I would like to use, where if a husband dies, the wife is then made to burn on the funeral pyre of the husband. Now this was represented in various ways as being something that was willingly done, you know, in order to, because of a deep devotion for the husband and so on. Invariably these arguments were made by men, right? You know, and invariably these arguments are made by men who would possibly not suffer a matchstick to light their little finger. Anyway, those are all ad hominem remarks, and we'll leave that aside for the moment. But when you think about Ram Mohan Roy, who is present, Raja Ram Mohan Roy, who was one of our most important social reformers in the late 18th century, how does he make a critique of the practice of sati? This is important to think about. When he makes a critique of the practice of sati, the way he poses the argument is that sati is not there in our shastras. Sati is not sanctioned in our religious texts, therefore we should do away with sati. This is an unexceptionable position. But at no point does he say, well, sati is wrong because it is inhuman. Sati is wrong because it actually devalues one life as against another. He doesn't make that argument. So there is something about that textualization of Hinduism, right, where Hinduism is seen as the Shastras, which creates problems even for Indian intellectuals in the perceptions of their own society, where they can only think in this intellectual, textual kind of way. The other thing to think about is, okay, so we've spoken about that end of the spectrum. Let's speak about the other end of the spectrum. A very famous case from the late 19th century of a woman who came, or a girl who came from the carpenter caste, one of the lower castes. She's married off when she's 5 or 6, as is the custom, but and goes back to live with her parents. As she grows, as she studies, she says that I don't want to go back to my husband. I have become educated. I have other desires for my life. I don't want to go back to my husband, even though it's guaranteed by law, because he's not somebody who's interested either in learning, nor is he interested in me. But the courts decide that this is not a choice that is available for a woman under the law, because they go by the Brahminical law. Now, one must know that at that particular point for the carpenter caste, notions of marriage were very, very tenuous. There was no notion of divorce, because there were relationships of various kinds that people entered into at various points. But what the colonial government did was to look at this point, or look at this case, through the textbook Brahminical law, and argued that this woman must go back to her husband. Of course, this became a huge case, the various nationalist leaders were involved in it. They said the British government shouldn't intervene. One of our famous leaders, nationalist leaders, who's made a name for himself by asserting in a colonial court that freedom is my birthright and I shall have it, said that, well, if this girl is not made to go back to her husband, all of Indian men will lose their masculinity. So obviously he didn't see freedom as being a birthright for this young girl. Right? So there are all these complicated positions that we need to think about. So finally, of course, the case has a happy ending, and those of you who want to know how the case ended may read this book by Sudhir Chandra. The reference will be, so we leave that as suspenseful for the moment. But let me tell you that Rakhmabai went on to lead a happy life, which is the right way to end for a commercial break, right? Either suspense or resolution. So the two cases that I've taken, that of the Shastras and the other, that of Rakhmabai, show you the consequences of a particular textualization of textualized understanding, where Brahminical religion and Brahminical law come to be seen as representative for all of India. And this is something that carries on and on and on. So when you have social reformers in the late 19th century, 100 years later, speaking about reviving Hinduism, they go back to the Vedas. They go back to the Upanishads. None of them say, let's look at the diversity of religious practices around us, in which some of which men and women are equal, some of which Hindus and Muslims worship together. They don't say, let's look at that. They say, let's go back to the Vedas. Let's go back to the Upanishads and so on. They go back to a textual tradition. It is only in the 1930s that the one man whom you all know about, Mahatma Gandhi, spelled G-A-N-D-H-I and not G-H-A-N-D-I, as the Americans spell it, Mahatma Gandhi, as they say. Mahatma Gandhi in the 1930s says, it does not matter to me whether something is there in the Shastras or it is not. There are certain things which are fundamentally wrong, like untouchability, and I shall fight it tooth and nail. That leap away from that textual tradition constructed by Colebrooke and Jones is made only in the 1930s by Mahatma Gandhi, who says, the textual tradition is not for me. There are certain things which are right, there are certain things which are wrong. And it is indeed that tradition that we need to evoke when we think about contemporary Hinduism as well, where we are actually looking at individual practice, we are looking at matters of individual conscience, and moving away from the text. So I'll stop there for the moment, and we can resume with the next part of the story, which gets exciting. There's more blood and gore to follow.